Arnchorn Pond is a survivor of the Cambodian genocide. He was 9 years old when Pol Pot seized power. His parents were killed and he was taken to a labor camp where he was held with about 700 other children. They lived in a renovated temple. The children were forced to work from 5 a.m. to midnight with only a little rice for nourishment. Pan says that 3 or 4 times a day, the Khmer Rouge would kill prisoners in the back of the temple while the other children were forced to watch, and sometimes were made to participate. In the camp, Pond was taught to play flute so that he could entertain the Khmer Rouge with propaganda songs. That helped keep him alive. After 4 years in the camps, he was forced to fight in the Khmer Rouge army against the invading Vietnamese. He ran away, survived in the jungle, and eventually found a refugee camp in Thailand, where he was adopted by an American relief worker. He now divides his time between Cambodia and Lowell, Massachusetts. Arnchorn Pond is the subject of the new documentary The Flute Player, which will be shown tomorrow night on many PBS stations as part of the POV series. I asked him why he thought the Khmer Rouge chose him to be one of the musicians in the children's labor camp.
They just ask if anybody want to play music or dance. They ask, and I sort of, my hand raised quickly. You have to make a decision with 5 other kids, 3 other kids, including me and the number 2 kids who play, who were chosen. They only chose the number 1 and the number 2, and the 3 of the boys were killed also. They didn't make it because they were not that good. And I was the number 1 player. I was better than anyone else, so they chose me. I would have been dead also if the 5 of us, if I didn't beat I didn't win the 5 of us. So I was faster than anyone else. They brought a teacher to come and taught us for 5 days, and I didn't even know the guy's name. He was an older man, and he was asked to teach us. And he told me I asked me to study hard. Otherwise, he will not stay here long. And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "The Khmer Rouge, I'm sure the Khmer Rouge will kill me." So, he taught me basic, and then I go on my own. And the other 2 kids succeed. The other three went up, they ended up in a mango grove.
That's a lot of pressure to learn learn music. So did you like anything about playing the flute?
No, I mean, it's like you say, it saved my life. I know that technically, physically saved my life. I mean, if I don't succeed it, I would have been dead. And it's every minute in the Khmer Rouge time, it's like life and death, I don't know how I did that. I did it, survived it. And plus, the starvation, it just, you would die. You just feel just starving. So whether the Khmer Rouge kill you or not, you're starving to death. I mean, half of the people were starving to death because they don't have give them food for many weeks and stuff. I hadn't worked so hard. At night I would have time to practice my music, the flute and the other instruments called the kim. It's like a dulcimer. And at night, I mean, the kids are, blood all over the center too. There's the people were killed at our center. That blood were not washed away. They're in the floor, and the kids were moaning. And at night, they had nightmares, and they throw up, and it smelled like in hell, in that place. And I usually didn't sleep. I couldn't sleep, and I remember that, around me there were a lot of kids who are, dying already and while they were sleeping. Not like me. I was probably around, I look around that I always couldn't sleep and look up at the windows and all of that. And I'd be able to play my music. And every time I escaped it, I escaped like where I was through the music that I play. I was able to practice. I would pretend that I was in somewhere nice, because of the sound of music, the harp, sound like a harp, the dulcimer. So I thought I was in heaven somewhere.
What was it like to perform for one of the leaders of the Khmer Rouge when you knew that they were just slaughtering people? They were responsible for genocide.
They asked me to play for them. So sometimes they kill people around so they wouldn't have to. They won't have to hear the sound of the screaming. They, I don't know what happened. Sometimes the Khmer Rouge kill people, and they have a microphone. You know, they have a, you know, loudspeaker playing music, their revolutionary song. So people know that if they do that, loud noise, they would kill people. You know, usually when I play the flute, I close my eyes. At the end of the playing, I hope when I open my eyes, I hope that I was not around by the Khmer Rouge. You know, it's, my minds go back and forth, you know, playing for the Khmer Rouge and playing for the kids in America, that I, you know, I want to feel myself feel safe, you know. So that's probably the epitome of my life now, go back and forth.
It's like when your eyes are closed, part of you is thinking about the days when you were playing for the
Khmer Rouge. Yeah, yeah. And also, you know, trying to tell myself that it's okay now, you're playing in America now, that you're playing for the people now, the good, you know, the children now.
After a couple of years in the camp, you were told that instead of playing flute, you had to pick up a gun and fight against the Vietnamese. What was behind this change?
Oh, the Vietnamese came, invaded in 1979, and I was taking the flute away and was given a gun to go out like other children. Thousands of other children were not prepared. I didn't even know how to shoot the guns, and the Khmer Rouge said that, you know, you have to figure it all out yourself. And we have no time to train. The enemies invade our country now. So, you know, like they trucks thousands of kids who were not Khmer Rouge to go and fight and die. And sometimes we were put in the middle like decoy. You know, like Vietnamese had experience fighting with Americans, you know. They're pretty good. And plus they have tanks, they have... If they were using the plane in the beginning, I would have been dead already. And sometimes when we didn't have an order to take off from the battlefield, the Khmer Rouge would shoot us behind. So we didn't know what side we were on. And I became good at it after a while, seeing many of my friends got shot left and right in the head. And because those kids are innocent, they didn't know how to fight or anything like that. And that's a very sad for me, a sad time for me. Change, but not change to be better, but, you know, it's more of I'm become, for a 12-year-old boy, become a real man now, what they call it, a real man, watching your friends killed left and right from you. And I remembered I felt very bad. I felt, in my life, I never want to feel that anymore. Like, hate, anger, and also, you know, like powerless, you know, you can't do anything while your friend died and right in your hand, like while you're holding them and blood all over you, and you can't help them. That's it's hard, because I have to feel hate, I have to feel in control in the battlefields like that, and then your friend died around you, and you feel powerless at the same time, you know. It's just hard.
You ran away from being a soldier. You ran into the forest and hid out there, and then eventually made your way to a refugee camp. What was the last straw for you? What made you decide to take the risk of running away?
Because I couldn't take it anymore. You know, I couldn't take the pain anymore, and it's just like living in the jungle. It's just hard too. The loneliness and in the jungle of Cambodia, you know, between Battambang province and the Thai border, it's just far. And I never knew that there was Thailand. I thought the world was flat, you know, for a little boy like that. I never knew anything about anything. I thought the jungle would never end. I almost wanted to kill myself a lot of times. And in the jungle, I mean, it's just so lonely. And a lot of time I was alone by myself. Sometimes I have few other people who we reunited in the jungle. You know, they got lost also. And sometimes when I was so small, and we've done a lot of things there, dangerous things in the jungle. You know, like they would ask me, those four or five older Khmer Rouge would ask me to fish for them, to do anything, and I don't want to do for them, and they hit me in the head, you know, like with the guns, and I run off from them again, I saw some human bones in the jungle. They were lost and they probably were killed by animals, especially snakes. You know, there's all everywhere, and just the risk already to eat any fruit. You know, the water was plenty in the jungle. You know, there's streams, small streams and stuff. But the food, I eat barks. I ate anything I could find there. Identify some of the leaves that I could eat without poisoning me, and usually the fruits. I mean, I've learned how to follow the monkey. Usually we're they all over the place, and if you don't do anything bad to them, they wouldn't do anything good to you. But I wouldn't stand a chance with them because there's so many of them. And if I just kill one of them, they probably would kill me. Which I snuck sometimes. A little monkey came around me. I just grab him and sit on him, and the next day I eat him. You know, to try him up and eat him. I mean, if their parent knows that I did that, they would kill me. I feel bad, you know, as human being doing that, killing. You know, I need to eat anyway, you know. So usually now I follow them wherever they go. I mean, whatever fruit they eat, I could eat also usually. So I just follow them a lot of places.
Right. Well, you were starving to death. So you finally got to a refugee camp. This was across the Thai border?
Yes.
Did you just stumble into it?
Yes. Yeah, I was probably close to death. I was about probably 30 pounds. I was close to death. And they took me and put me in the camp like everyone else. I couldn't even get up. And, malaria. I had, cerebral malaria. And... you know, after living so long in the jungle,
At this refugee camp, you met a Unitarian minister named Peter Pond, who became your adoptive father. Why did he decide to adopt you and take him home with you to the United States?
No, I had no idea. I mean, I was among, again, about 500 children along the border were put into the camp, and where I saw first time, I was incomprehensive. I mean, I was the... you know, like, you know, no food and all that. I could not take any food they give us children. We would throw up and us like that because of the, you know, of the starvation. But I think that particular night, many children were drowned to death. I mean, it was monsoon rain, I remembered, and I couldn't get up. I couldn't move, and some kid were drowned to death. And I was also about to drown and at night. And, I mean, people rescuing us, you know, from different country, you know. And my dad was, like, trying to rescue other kids, too, but he accidentally stumbled on me and, stepped on me. I don't know how many pounds he has, but he stepped on me, and all I remember was that I cling on to him, never let it go, never let him go. And he told me later on, he said, you know, the reason I come to you, I see you more than anybody else. I pick you because your teeth. I had a really, you know, I had a white teeth at night. I clung on him and I probably screamed at him or something, and he saw my teeth, and the next morning he come back again trying to find me among the children, and there probably some children died during that night. So I think he had something for me, I don't know.
Now, among the things that you're doing now, you're working with gangs, and what do you relate to about gang members?
They are similar to what I went through in Cambodia. They are probably the, you know, the child of war also themselves in the street of law and provenance. You know, they are confused about who they are, you know, as a, you know, identity. I mean, they're who they, some of the Cambodian I know, they said, you know, the gang kids, they said, I don't know who I am. You know, I'm maybe Spanish. I want to be white. You know, I want to be this. I want to be that. So the same thing with the other white kids who are joined gang or Spanish kids and stuff like that. And somebody stare at them, they shoot them. Or they have a fight with them, strike by shooting or anything. It's just confusion of identity and the need to have. I don't know what needs they, what kind of need they want. There's so many things, you know. They want money, they want other things, you know. But it's just confusion inside of their head, just like I was when I came here. I don't know where I want to go in life, and you know why I ended up here, you know, and stuff like that.
One of the projects you're doing in Cambodia is called the Masters Project. Tell us something about it.
Yes, they kill. You know, many of master were killed during, you know, 30 years of war. You know, a war that started Americans and Vietnamese fighting each other, and then get Cambodia involved in the war and American bomb Cambodia for a long time. And now I learn, you know, it's sad to say, more bomb dropped in Cambodia than in Japan in World War II, dropped in Southeast Asia, and in Cambodia got the hard hit, and they die there, and worse of that, the Cambodian end up, end up in the killing field. That's really really bad for Cambodia, and the master musician, 90% of them disappeared. And so what do we do with the art and culture in my country? And that's the soul of my country, and that's the identity of my country and of my people. And what are you going to do with that? No artist who's like a national treasure left in Cambodia. So I found some of them now still disoriented from the war and from the killing fields and trying to hide their self-identity and hide their name, you know, because they're so scared. They're still so scared. And many of them are on the street, you know, selling charcoal and cigarettes, and not so many people care about them. And I was able to find them and now let them teach and record them before they die, you know, and let them perform again.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Arnchorn Pond is the subject of the documentary The Flute Player. It will be shown on many PBS stations tomorrow night as part of the POV series. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.